It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Okay, hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany and this is my show. And today we are back to the Beginner's Guide of Pro Wrestling in Japan. Let's start again. We are back to the Beginner's Guide to Japan and Pro Wrestling in Japan. And this is episode today. Today we are looking at All Japan Women and a card from 1990, the All Japan Grand Prix. Now, the reason why I suggested this card for a review is because it has all the major players in All Japan Women in the next few years. It's not a card that features the until then draws, the Crush Girls, and it's a nice jumping off point for when AJW went to be the best promotion in wrestling ever. So, for me, this is a very important card because it's not the cool stuff, it's the cool stuff that becomes the cool stuff. And to join me to discuss this card is Mr. Alexander Watt of the BBC. How are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you.
Good, good. And also, Miss Chelsea Spollen of ShouldersUp.net. How are you, Mark?
Doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you very, very much. Though I just did nearly choke on the end of my coffee, but I'll be okay. Now, this is the All Japan Grand Prix, which was an important tournament based... it's an important tournament in the All Japan history. And we've talked many, many times before on the Troopany Show about the importance of tournaments in Japanese pro wrestling. In 1990, it was a six-person elimination tournament, and it had various different formats down the years. So it had quarterfinals, three quarterfinals, two semifinals, and a final. And amongst that was some interesting stuff as well from non-tournament matches. So Chelsea, what did you think of this overall card just going into it, and what had you known about it, and what did you think you were expecting to come across when you watched it?
Well, when I looked at the match list, I was like, wow, there's some really great wrestlers on this card, so this is going to be fun. And it was, but it wasn't what I was expecting. The biggest surprise for me was who was really popular with the audience and who wasn't. Because a lot of that was just the reverse of my expectations, I guess. The wrestling was great. there's a couple of things that are like, there's a couple of matches that work better than others where you watch it and think, oh, that's, you know, maybe not quite up to the standard of the thing that followed. But overall, it's a really good pay-per-view. It's really interesting.
What about you, Alex? What were your initial impressions and what did you know about it before we started?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's funny you've just said about like this is the stuff before it becomes like the big thing, if you like, because that is sort of 92 to 95 is kind of the era of All Japan Women I'm like most familiar with and have seen the most of. So this was like, you know, different for me, certainly how like, you know, we'll chat about like Manami Toyota, Akira Hakuto, like how young they are in this and how like how kind of strange that was. Like
they're Akira so Hakuto. Baby-faced.
Yeah, like Akira Hakuto doesn't look like Akira Hakuto at all. Like what you know, her most famous look and style. So it was quite strange from that aspect for me. It was like, you know, a whole new thing for me, if you like.
Yeah, she was a marine wolf then. She wasn't the Dangerous Queen yet, was she? So it's, and that was the second phase of the Akira Hakuto story. So this is there's some convoluted bits we've got to talk about. But I strongly recommend you watch this card if you want to find out what Joshi Progresso is supposed to look like. This is what it's supposed to look like, as far as I'm concerned, especially in the 1990s. And you get a feel from the overall booking of the card how they're going to work things, especially the opening match, which isn't a wrestling match. This is Bachi Shinga versus Mayumi Yamamoto in a kickboxing match. Now, if you go back to the Dream Slam 1 review that me and Chelsea did last year, we are well aware of Miss Yashinga and her ability to kick people really, really hard. And her love of the haymaker. And basically, I watched this match and I just went, but the little woman's going to get killed. And for three rounds, she basically did. In fact, I don't actually understand how she managed to stay on her feet after getting clobbered like that in 3 5-minute rounds for so long, to be honest with you. So, Alex, you're an MMA reporter by trade. What did you think of this?
Well, not anymore, really, but I was, yeah. But Well, first thing I like put on the, we watched this obviously from the YouTube playlist, which is worth saying. Anyone who wants to watch the matches, go and check that out. They're all on there. Like, I switched it on and was like, have I switched on the wrong thing? Like, because it was, this isn't wrestling. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much what you said, which was someone getting beaten up for three rounds, and like by the end of it, her nose was like halfway across her face, which was
there was blood everywhere in this match. It was, but yeah,
it was interesting way to kick off a card, really, and it was it wasn't MMA as I would recognize it. Perhaps it was very scrappy, but it was interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Chelsea, what did you think of this?
Well, it's very stiff, but it's also kind of unpolished, and I sort of wonder if maybe that was intentional. Like, almost everything else on this card is so slick in terms of the presentation, and I sort of wonder if maybe this was intentionally supposed to be the opposite. Like, I don't know. Alex's word scrappy is a good one. It's a little hard to watch. I tried to find information about Mayumi Yamamoto, and I really couldn't find anything. She was in some other AJW events, but I couldn't find anything about her career, even on Cage Match. Does anybody know anything about
her? No, I don't either. I mean, the turnover for girls in the AJW dojo was so high.
Yeah.
And there's people on here that, you know, you look at, like, they've got fairly well up the card, but you don't hear much of them after this match, after this tournament. You know, Norio Tatano in the first round matches, you don't really hear much of her wrestling much after this, to be honest with you, in AJW history. So, yeah, she may be, and she may actually have been a kickboxer anyway, as we saw, you know, quite often they brought in kickboxers for Batyushin to fight in, and I'm kind of guessing this was a shoot fight rather than, or it might have been a worked shoot fight where they were really hitting each other, even though, mind you, did it really have to be? Because obviously Batyushin was about 2 inches taller and about 30 pounds heavier, so.
Yeah.
You know.
Batyoshinaga clearly was the more experienced of the two, but even about her, I went looking for information about her career and I couldn't find anything from after 1996.
We'll have to go to the Joshi gods of research like Kevin at Puro Central and see what he says. I'll ask. Okay, then we moved on then to the second match, which bizarrely was the All Pacific title match between Aja Kong, the then champion, against Suzuki Minami. Now, the All Pacific title at this point had a strong lineage. It was the second title. It was the match that is the title match that's supposed to get everybody excited for the rest of the show. And there'd been some strong champions down the years, Devil Masami being a good case in point. Now, Aja Kong was about 4 years into her career and was steadily plodding her way to the main event. And in this match, she lost the title in about 6 minutes via disqualification. Yes, titles change hands by disqualification in Japan. We may have mentioned that before. But this was an interesting piece of violence because there's no other way of describing it. It starts with Aja Kong hitting Suzuki Minami with a chair really quite hard, and it goes from there. Chelsea, what were your thoughts on this match?
So I feel sorry for Aja Kong's opponent pretty much always, no matter who they are, and this match was no exception. I actually felt like she was holding back, like Aja Kong was holding back. I've seen matches from around this period where she delivered even stiffer violence than this. It was also really interesting to me that Suzuka Minami, her opponent, was... seemed to be more popular with the audience. And I don't know how much of that was just that Aja was, like, you know, a really, really good heel, and so they were rooting for whoever the baby face was, or if that was because they really particularly liked her. She's a solid wrestler. I was kind of surprised that I hadn't heard of her, because I was watching the match thinking, oh, she's pretty good. She seems like she knows what she's doing. She can keep up with Aja Kong. But... I did some digging online and there were other people basically saying the same thing. You're like, oh, she was just, it was the bad time to try to become a standout, because if you weren't in that like upper godly level tier, you were going to get left behind by the audience and by the company.
Yeah.
It's a good match, but it's a little jarring to see it in 2017 thinking like, you know, all the stuff that Aja Kong does after this, and also like, oh, hey, where did her opponent go?
Yeah, this is the interesting bit for me, because like Suzuki Minami was not a bad wrestler by any stretch of the imagination, but it is
no,
just,
she's pretty good.
It is just like, you know, you look at the people in this on this card. There's Aja Kong, there's Minami Toyota, there's Akira Okoto, Yumika Hotta. They're in the top six of the top 10 greatest wrestlers of all time. Not just not just women's wrestlers, the greatest wrestlers of all time. You know, and it, to stand out in that kind of company is just it was just not really possible. If you were of only, you know, exceptional talent, you weren't going to stand out. So, yeah. Which sounds crazy, but it's true. Alex, what did you think of this match?
Yeah, I think it's a good point as well, because obviously you've got then Minami Toyota coming through, because to me, Minami looked that she was trying to do that kind of babyface thing, and it's like when you've got Toyota coming through, who's like arguably the best babyface ever, it's like you are going to get left behind by not being as good as her kind of thing. But yeah, like it was interesting to see Aja Kong from kind of that era before, like Chelsea says, she really became like the big deal, like as her career went on. And like you said, it was basically like the match was basically Kong hitting Minami with anything which wasn't nailed down. It seemed like at one point I think she grabbed a handbag from a fan and just started hitting her with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very World of Sport, I thought. Like shout out to the grandmas. But yeah, I mean, not knowing, you know, a whole bunch about like the history around this period, I'm assuming the idea here was like they had the short match, she cheated and lost the title. It was probably to set up a later title match, like a rematch. That sort of, it just felt like a vehicle to get them to like a bigger rematch at another show.
I think, well, I mean, there are three phases to Kong's career. There's the opening phase where she was your typical AJW rookie in a black swimsuit. And I think, you know, forcing her to wear a black swimsuit for 2 years is probably what made her angry.
Yeah.
I would be.
Yeah. And she was still rocking the mohawk then. And then she moves into this phase of the career where she's getting out of the shadow of Dokaki Gedome and Bull Nakano and Dump Matsumoto, because she was in their stable to start with. She's starting Jungle Jack around this time, which is her stable with Bison Kimura. And Grizzly Iwatani, who we'll see later in this tournament. So she's basically winding her way to a full main event feud with Bull Nakano. So that's the...
Yeah, so was this slightly before that feud then? Was that...
Yeah, that was 92, obviously, wasn't it? 91, 92. So right. Slightly yeah. before that, which really cemented her as a main event talent. And I think they were trying to get her away from the All-Pacific Championship so that they could make her a main event player. She didn't need that title to get there, which is interesting. So then we get onto the tournament proper, and the first match is Medusa Miceli versus Noriano Tateno. Am I pronouncing that right, Chelsea?
Tateno, yeah.
Tateno, yeah. And Medusa Miceli and Tateno have a really good match. You know, I always knew Medusa Miceli was really, really good, and I didn't really watch her Japanese stuff until after I'd like watched her American stuff. But this shows really how much faith All Japan women had in her. She had a really... It was one of those interesting Japanglish promos people do, where yeah. they're trying to speak in as simple English as possible to make it understandable for a Japanese audience, yet they managed to get rid of all the grammar or any meaning. which is a bit strange, but the actual match itself was really solid. I really enjoyed this match. Alex, what were your thoughts on this?
Yeah, same. Interesting, you know, same as you. I haven't seen a whole lot of Medusa before her American stuff, so it's really certainly as well like to see her how young she was, which is going to be a running theme throughout this, I think. I'm like, they're all so young. But yeah, it was like you say, I think particularly like the last 5 minutes when, you know, they kicked it into another gear again. We should say, like, this is a really interesting starting point for Joshi anyway, for anyone who's coming to it, because of the pace that the wrestlers keep, which I think, you know, if it's the first time you ever watch Joshi, it's like you you may not be expecting that, because they don't start like with you know, submission holds and things like that and work their way up. They literally just hit the ground running for the most part and just start beating the crap out of each other. So this was like a good example of that, of how quick the pace is, and in like what, a 9-10 minute match, something like that. So yeah, I thought it was really good, and we chatted a little bit just before we started recording about the finish, which was kind of a double pin, but it wasn't clear whether they'd done a draw or if it was who was advancing to the next round or and stuff like that, which is partly because of the language barrier. But that was the only bit where it was like, so what's happened there? Like, what's the deal?
Well, as neither of them appear in the semi-finals, we kind of assume then it was as a double pin, they were both eliminated. The trouble is, the Wikipedia page for this particular tournament lists Medusa Miceli as the winner of that match, but she clearly didn't win. So I'm assuming that Wikipedia for wrestling, 9 times out of 10, is pretty accurate. So, but I think in this one, it might have just been missed.
Maybe a fanboy went in there and edited it because he didn't like the fact
that WWE Hall of Famer Medusa Miceli lost.
By the way, on that, I was thinking the other day, obviously Medusa's in the Hall of Fame. Why is Bull Nakano not in the Hall of Fame yet? That's really weird to me.
I'd argue the reason why she left the company was because she was caught in possession of cocaine, so that might have something to do with it. I think it's also...
Who gives a crap?
Yeah.
Like, she's 17, and she's Bull Nakano!
some of the stuff that, you know...
Hey, I'm just saying!
But you may very well be right. It's just like, that's very hypocritical if that's the case.
Yeah. Casting no aspersions... But, you know, I could think of a guy who died recently who's in the Hall of Fame. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I didn't want to go there, allegedly. But,
you want to talk about illegal drug use. Triple H used to not be able to put his arms all the way down. Come on!
Allegedly. You have to say allegedly after everything, Chelsea. That's what covers you.
Well, I'm not a professional journalist, but allegedly.
But I just think... You know, it's just because they're talking, obviously, about the rumors that it's going to be Beth Phoenix who goes in this year, and it was just like, which she deserves fully. It was just got me thinking, why is Bull Nakano not in there yet? It just seems odd.
It does seem incredibly odd, especially as she had an actual extended run in WWE. You could say the same for the Crush Girls, and you could probably say the same for the Jumping Bomb Angels. But and especially when you consider Tatsumi Fujinami, who had, what, 3 matches in 1978?
Exactly, yeah.
Is in the Hall of Fame. And Antonio Inoki, who again had about 4 matches spread out over the space of 5 years in the WWF or WWWF, they're in the Hall of Fame, but they're guys. So, Chelsea, what did you think of this particular piece of work?
So I liked this match a lot. One of the first things I sort of thought of while I was watching it is that this match to me felt like the template for a lot of what Stardom is doing now. You sort of have like Norio Tateno may not have been super, super popular with the fans at this particular period of time, but I mean, she did go on to be half of the Jumping Bomb Angels. So like she is an important footnote in this particular time period of wrestling. And Medusa, I mean, you know, she's an incredibly famous American wrestler. And I sort of think it's a shame that WWE won't let her unretire, even though she keeps trying to cut Twitter promos on their wrestlers now so that she can convince them it would be a good idea. You know, you've got the evil Gaijin and the Japanese girl babyface, and it's a good match. I think these two, it's interesting because like the double pinfall, I don't really know what the storyline point of that was. Is it supposed to be that they're both like equally skilled competitors, or is the idea that, you know, they're going to have a rematch to set up a feud or something like that. Like, I wasn't really sure why they did that, or if it was that they didn't want the Japanese girl to lose, but then they couldn't get Medusa to agree to do the match if she was going to lose. I don't know.
I don't know. I not necessarily think it was politics. I've definitely seen Miceli lose in All Japan Women. I think it was probably more to the fact they wanted to get a certain final. Because when we get to the next, in a couple of matches time, I'll explain a few more bits which might make you guys go, ah. So maybe we best leave it till then.
Okay.
But I wanted to leave.
But there was, I mean, my feeling throughout was that a lot of the endings were kind of trying to be like, make everyone look strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of that, like, quick pins or people kicking out just after the three, and obviously here the double pin and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
Well, actually, the next match on the list was a definitive finish. You couldn't get much more emphatic than this particular match. Mika Hotta defeated Grizzly Iwamoto. The best name for a wrestler, isn't it? Grizzly Iwamoto.
It's so good.
It's so cool, good. Especially for a female wrestler. You know, and Hotta defeated Iwamoto with just some serious kicks to the head and a knockout finish, which is a finish you don't see very often in wrestling anymore. And it was perfectly placed here. It set her up as the big bad for this particular tournament. Mika Hotta looked hot going into this tournament anyway from what she was doing around the time. And, you know, she comes in as the big mixed martial arts style, the kind of shoot style wrestler that she is, all these big kicks, and it really got her kicks over by knocking out Iwamoto, who had a reputation for being a stand-up tough brawler, you know. So it worked really, really well for this particular match. Chelsea, what did you think of it?
So the thing that stood out to me at first was that how much the crowd loves Yumiko Hotta. Like, they're just in love with her. It could be that there's just like a small group of fans that are particularly vocal, but it really sounded like the crowd was super into her for this whole match. It's a really good match. It's a little brutal. they really, really hit each other. But it's not just people hitting each other. I mean, there's some fairly elegant wrestling in it too. You know, there's some turnbuckle spots that are kind of impressive.
Yeah.
I don't really think of Yumiko Hotta as someone who the fans probably think of as like a classic babyface. Like, I was kind of surprised that people root for her, because to me she seems to be sort of the antithesis of sort of a lot of what was popular at the time. Does that make sense? Like, she's not the super pretty, super feminine pop idol type.
No, I agree with you. And you kind of, this is the point where you're starting to get a change in fan base as well. You know, I think also, Hotta spent the last 10 years as a heel too. You know, modern day narrative you've seen her recently in Reina or in guesting as a freelancer, she's probably been a heel. So that kind of like sometimes rests on your expectations a bit. But back then, those girls you talked about, you listened to that crowd, and then you listened to a crowd from 1992, and there's a lot less teenage female voices in that audience. It's starting this is where you're starting to get the break away from the core audience of AJW, which was the teenage girl audience. Not to say that they disappeared entirely, but it became much more of, it was no longer a girls wrestling promotion as far as the fans were concerned. All wrestling fans start to be interested in it because of the work rate in these matches, because of the stories they're trying to tell. You know, it suddenly matures as a product, and I think this is probably the last gasp of the teenage girl audience. And the daft thing was, when a couple of years ago, when Chigusa Nagayo did a comeback show, she did a self-produced show to announce the birth of Marvelous, and it was the same women in the audience who had been in the Crush Girls peak. They were doing the same chants because they did shots of the audience. There were clearly women in their 40s who were still missed the Crush Girls and wanted.
So great.
grown up with the product.
That's it. She had not evolved her audience in one stage. It was literally the very same people.
If anybody deserves that, though, it's Chivas and the guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. So, you know. So this is kind of like the last kind of gasp of that teenage girl audience. Not to say that they disappeared entirely. It's just that they kind of got drowned out by the male voices in the crowd, who suddenly became very, very interested in what was going on.
Which is funny, because hasn't it sort of swung a little bit back the other way? Like, whenever I see footage of Dragon Gate or DDT or New Japan Pro, the majority of the audience is usually female.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's... I don't know. It'd be interesting to see, like, doing a study on that, like, as far as audience participation is concerned, like, what the numbers are actually like and what why are you attracting so many female fans? Alex, what did you think of this match?
Yeah, picking up on that as well, the crowd was really loud for the whole show, which was noticeable. Which is not, I think if you come at it from, you know, the stereotype of what Japanese crowds are like, and then you watch something like this and they're raucous throughout, it might be quite surprising to a lot of people. And yeah, Hotta was super over. And like you said, what I got from it was, like, throughout they were setting her up as, like, the badass who was gonna just kill people throughout, which makes the final then. This is like clever tournament storytelling of basically you set her up as the badass who's killing everyone, and then you put, like, the ultimate baby face against her in the final who has to overcome those odds. And yeah, this was like the great example of setting up that story with her taking out Grizzly, who's like super tough, with an amazing look as well. She with the makeup and stuff, she looks incredible.
Yeah,
the kabuki eyes.
Yeah, it's such a cool look. And then the fact that she's like a badass as well, and you've got then Hotta just basically kicks her head off, basically. it was really well done. Like we say, this is why people revere Japanese tournaments, because they get that storytelling aspect throughout that you have to build to. You have to build stars throughout it, basically.
Yeah.
It makes each step more important.
Yeah, I mean Grizzly Iwamoto was also Bull Nakano's number two. You know, she was the leader of, it was what Gokeki Dome became, and I can't remember, but Gokeki Domu? Domon, something like that. I can't remember exactly the name. You could probably find that out. But yeah, she was the number. She was like the one. There was a match not long after this in the build up, as part of the Bull Nakano Aja Kong feud, where Aja and Bison Kimura wrestled Grizzly Iwamoto and Bull Nakano, and that is the biggest case of gratuitous no-selling I've ever seen. Bison Kimura and Aja Kong just beat Bull Nakano with kendo sticks literally for a full 2 minutes until they can't swing their arms anymore. And they're hitting her as hard as they can, and Bull Nakano stands there and smiles. And it's like they're really trying. They're not pulling anything. They're thrashing her with it, and she just stands there and takes it. And it's like, yeah, you can do that because you're Bull Nakano.
I love Bull Nakano.
Yes. Then we move on to, well, something really quite special. Minami Toyota defeats Akira Hokuto in the first round. Now, this is the interesting thing. The match is just absolutely phenomenal for around about 8 minutes. And when I was asked by FSM last year to write up a list of matches that I thought were the best Minami Toyota matches, I put this as my first pick. And it's not necessarily the best match you see Minami Toyota in, but it is the most emotionally involved match you see Minami Toyota in. Minami Toyota at this point in her career is not quite the perfect vessel of a wrestler that she will become. She's a bit gangly, she's a bit clumsy, and she's not polished up the way she is. Everything's there. The entire toolkit is there. And similarly, Akira Hokuto, as Alex said earlier, is not the Dangerous Queen yet. She's the Marine Wolf. You know, she's a different person to the rookie who started, whose name was Isaka Ono, the original name for Akira Hokuto, who got her neck broken 2 years before and had a year off and then reinvented herself as Akira Hokuto and came back to All Japan Women in 1989. So this is a completely different wrestler to the one we'd seen 2 years before. However, this is the match where both of them literally wrote their legend in what wrestling would become. The match is just absolute breakneck speed for a start. Hokuto goes to the top rope at one point after having a dominant stretch and goes for a flying crossbody off the top rope, but catches a knee on the top of the guardrail and tears her knee. And absolutely refuses to give in and will not stop until the Matsunaga brothers actually come in the ring and say, you can't continue because we don't want you damaged any more than you are. And you now may understand when I say that Hokuto was actually booked to win this tournament, why she didn't want to give up. obviously. Mm. And also that explains some of the match finishes.
I didn't realize she was booked to win.
Yeah, this was supposed to be her coming out party as the next leader of the locker room and the next major push of the stars. And, you know, there is... Hokuto has a career of this happening to her, which is the reason why she was so angry and did not want to end the match, you know. But to me, this is where you have really the two characters that define the 90s AJW style, the pure science of Manami Toyota, which is just burgeoning and growing as it is, and the just sheer utter toughness of Akira Hokuto. You know, so that's the reason why I think this match is really important. Alex, what did you think of this bout?
Yeah, I think you've said a lot of the stuff I was going to say there. I mean, they're two of the all-time greats, unquestionably. And, I've seen a lot of their later matches, like their classics, but I hadn't seen this one. So it was interesting to see, them as, essentially not, you know, rookies, but the next step up, where they're still very young and they're still not what they would become, if you know what I mean. Like you said with Manami Toyota, she's not the wrestler she will be in a few years, but she's still, you can still see her style, where she, like, you know, she starts the match with the trademark high tempo, you know, drop kicking loads and attacking Hokuto on the outside and everything like that, and them wrestling at the breakneck pace, like you say. And yeah, again, like the thing with Hokuto, because every year we do the end of year awards and we have the Akira Hokuto Award. So if anyone's ever questioned why we do that, I think this is a pretty solid example of why, because that is nuts. She can't even stand up and she wants to finish the match. That is a tough SOB, as they say.
She's certifiably a little nuts, but she's so great.
Yeah
basically.
she doesn't even cry until she realizes she can't wrestle. That's when she cries. And that's not her putting things on. That is her genuine, that's how emotional she was about it. She just absolutely lives and dies by wrestling. That's all she lived for. And still does, thankfully. Mm. And hopefully for a long time to come. But we will see. Anyway, Chelsea, what did you think of this particular match?
Oh my God, this is so electric. I love this match. I was really, really excited to see super young babyface Manami Toyota.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that really stood out to me about this and watching her in this match, and I said this on Twitter last night while I was watching it, is that she is mostly indifferent to how the crowd feels about her. She's so into the wrestling. The wrestling is what's really, really important to her. She does not care if she looks cool or if she looks pretty. You know, she'll stand in a way that most female baby faces would just never stand, because it's not designed to make her look, you know, super pretty or feminine. And she just doesn't care. She wants to have the best match that she can. And that's the only thing that matters to her. And you mentioned before that she's a little gangly in this match. She's not quite as polished as she becomes later. But I feel like that, supreme confidence and coolness is a big part of what turns her into the godlike wrestler that she becomes. Akira Hokuto is so much fun to watch here also. My heart breaks for her at the end. I had never seen her cry before. also, I have to admit, I was wrong. She does have the best toe point Northern Lights suplex
there you go.
Of all time. it's just freaking great. I screamed a little bit when I was watching it. Yeah, this match is so good that there's a playlist of a bunch of their matches on YouTube, and I went and watched a bunch of them right after because I really enjoyed it. It's very clearly the start of something special, and it's not hard to see why both of these two are, you know, in the rankings for the best of all time.
Yeah, it really, even if you don't watch the rest of this card, you need to watch that match.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll move on, though, to the semi-final. Because there was only semi-final. Because of the double pin, Minami Toyota got a bye into the final. And Yumiki Hota had to have her semi-final match against Misuku Nishiwaki, who had also had a bye in the first round. Sorry to confuse you, but this is the way it laid out. Now, just I want to say something here. We talked last week about Akira Maeda and his influence on Japanese wrestling. And this performance by Nishiwaki was definitely a Maeda-style performance. You could arguably say the match with Hota was very UWF. They didn't really need... They run the ropes a bit towards the end, but they didn't even really need to do that. You know, it all worked very much on the mat, and it was all about submission. And the basic principle was Nishiwaka was trying to neutralize Hota's kicks. Nishiwaka wasn't a bad kicker herself. It wasn't her primary offensive weapon. But she, in the first 2 minutes, she applies a figure four leg lock. She's constantly going for double leg takedowns. She has a heel hook on one point, and she has leg bars, and every leg submission you can possibly think of go on in the first few minutes of the match. So it's a fascinating story to watch, even though, again, it might not be the best classic wrestling match you're ever likely to see, but all the tools are there to make it something really special. Alex, what did you think of this match?
Yeah, I agree. Like, that's... Again, smart storytelling, and you're making Hota look like a badass, because it's like Nishiwaki doesn't want to stand there with her. She wants to neutralize that part of her offense, which plays into that as well, which is, yeah, how clever these wrestlers were. And then, yeah, the last, I don't know, basically the closing stretch, it just devolved into them kicking and suplexing the crap out of each other, which was quite glorious. And, you know, that's what we came for, let's be honest. So, like I say, it's just, they set up really well. Hota is this absolute killer. And I mentioned it before, like, Nishiwaki looked strong in defeat still. She kicks out just after three. So it's like, oh, she was, you know, so close to winning. And it's, you know, it's a clever way of booking it and keeping people looking strong. But yeah, it was a fun match.
It's very interesting, this one. I do like it a lot, because it's just different kind of pace to what you used to in All Japan Women. Chelsea, what did you think of this match?
I really enjoyed this, and again, I kept thinking of some of the stuff that I see Stardom do now. Like, the pacing really reminded me of that, and the stiffness. And this match is really crisp in a lot of places, which I sort of... You know, like, a lot of the previous matches on this card are not as crisp, because they're not quite as polished. Like, they're still really great, really exciting matches, but they're not... I don't know how to phrase it. Like, that some of that smoothness isn't there, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think some of that might just be that, like, Yumiko Hota is such a bruiser. Like, she'll just, like, stamp you down right away. And she can, you know, lift somebody's just so effortlessly, or seemingly effortlessly. She doesn't seem to run out of strength. Like, she never gets blown up, you know?
Yeah.
It's a really interesting match, because I felt bad for Mitsuko Nishiwaki, because I knew she wasn't going to win. It's Yumiko Hota. Like, but she tries so hard. Like, she really tries so hard. And she tries not to let herself get emotional about it, too. Like, you can see her trying really hard to focus, and it's really good storytelling. I also, frankly, her style reminds me a little bit of some of the matches I've seen that Becky Lynch had before she became as polished as she is now. So I was kind of surprised that she, like, this is one of those cases where I had to go and look her up, because I was like, oh, yet another really pretty decent wrestler who I've never heard of from this time period, because she's not quite as famous as all the huge stars.
Yeah.
You know, she was really good, but she's just not Yumiko Hota, and that's not her fault.
No, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying about Stardom, because we could go over that a little bit. I think we probably should, actually. For those of you who don't know, Stardom was founded originally by Nanai Takahashi, as well as Rossi Yagawa and Fuka, who currently run the company. Rossi Yagawa and Fuka currently run the company. And when Nanai Takahashi was in charge, she was the last great graduate of the AJW dojo. She was the last true believer, as it were, of this system. And I would think, undoubtedly, she spent some time being trained by Yumiki Hotta. And certainly, she was a long-standing AJW main eventer. She main evented her and her partner had a long-term feud with the LCO over the tag team titles. They main evented quite a few events for AJW. So this kind of storytelling is what she grew up on and certainly was the mainstay of the early days of Stardom when she was champion. And I'm guessing it's kind of filtered down into the current training regime of Stardom, even though Stardom doesn't really have that association anymore with Nana Takahashi. She's obviously left her stamp on the promotion. And obviously, you know, Stardom's red belt and white belt come directly from the AJW lineage, as well as the black belt for tag team championships too.
Right.
That's all linked into the WWA championships. WWWA championships, I should say. There's definitely a lot of influence in Stardom. I kind of describe it as Stardom is the modern take on AJW, where Sendai Girls is the modern take on Gaia. You know, so
That makes perfect sense.
You know, Karen.
Meiko Satomura was trained by Chigusa Nagaya, so makes perfect sense.
That's what the Nanai Takahashi Meiko Satomura feud of 2012-13. Was so important to the history of Joshi because it was essentially the last great bastion of Gaia versus the last great bastion of AJW. So there's a lot of history involved in that, you know. And it doesn't really happen so much in Stardom anymore because obviously Io Shirai and Mayu Iwatani and Kairi Hojo kind of like run the dojo now. They're the ones that are imprinting their thoughts on pro wrestling on those workers. But then again, who trained Hojo and who trained Iwatani was Nanai Takahashi. So, yeah, we're talking about second and third generations of it filtering through this storytelling style. And I guess that's one of the things that's probably the easiest thing to transfer because it is essentially, it's an oral history of how you tell these stories. And you get it at two levels because you can go back and watch the video of these matches and you can be taught how to do it directly by, the people who did it in the first place because a lot of them are still wrestling.
Which is incredible.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, I was looking, like, this card was like August 1990, so essentially it was 26 and a half years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know...
you saw Manami Toyota this year, wrestling, for instance, so...
Yeah, and Yumiki Hotta was having shoot fights last month.
Yes, that's crazy.
There's no quitting her.
No, arguably she probably shouldn't have been doing. But anyway, yeah. So
yeah, no one
you try
tell
telling
her,
her no.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one would dare tell her no.
Yeah. All right, but that leads us on to the final, which was Yumiki Hotta versus Manami Toyota in a match that was incredibly heated, incredibly emotional. The crowd are so into this match. And you can tell Toyota is so amped up because she makes Hotta bleed hard way in the first 30 seconds. She busts her nose straight off. She just literally runs across the ring, knees her in the face and breaks her nose. So she was on it. And the what you were saying about Chelsea, some of those, that undying confidence really bleeds through in the opening segment of this match. What did you think of it, Chelsea?
Oh, man, this is so good. It's a little hard to watch because they really hit each other really hard. But it's so good. There's so much passion and electricity there. Like, they both just love what they're doing so much and they want to be the best. And it's really, really potent and really amazing. It's really funny to see, again, super young, super baby-faced, you know, Manami Toyota wearing, like, pink... frilly, like, you know, they send her out in like a satin jacket that she just like throws off and then she like runs over and is like, hey, I'm gonna break your nose. She doesn't care about how they want to present her. She just wants to be the best, and you can tell. And Yumiko Hoda wants the same thing, and the clash between the two of them is just so great. I really, really loved this. I can easily see why Manami Toyota getting booked to win this was a good call, because if you can beat Yumiko Hoda at this point where she's so over with the audience, then obviously, you know, that's the company like pushing her up and endorsing her. And I feel like also it doesn't really cost Yumiko Hoda anything, because this match is so brutal and so good that it's like, well, you lost to somebody who was on par with you. You know, it doesn't feel, at least to me, it didn't feel like it demoted her any. It was just like, it was a really excellent, even competition.
Yeah, the impression is you didn't lose. She didn't win. She survived.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. No, I completely agree with you. And it's interesting because Toyota kind of has three phases as well. She's at this point, she's just getting out of the Tokyo Sweethearts thing, which has lingered since 1989. And you're right, she doesn't look comfortable, does she, in that outfit?
No.
And not long after this, she kind of like goes to kind of like pineapple workout gear, which is a bit more her. and then she goes into the flowing flare-esque robes that we know her for, and the ostrich feathers and the craziness.
Now she dresses like Xena Warrior Princess, which is so great.
But one thing I do find interesting, and certainly the opening sequence of this match, is Toyota isn't a pure babyface in the traditional sense. She wants to win, and she will do anything to win. And if she needs to cheat, she'll cheat. Yeah, and that's always a fascinating thing for me. She's a babyface, but she has an edge. She cares about winning just as much as anything else. Actually, one of my favorite moments of a Toyota match ever was a match I saw her with, where she's tagging with Aja Kong against Toshiya Yamada and Bull Nakano, and it goes to a 45-minute time limit draw, and she's so pissed off that there isn't a winner. She's so pissed off that they couldn't win. And this is obviously it's storytelling, but she's wrestling her biggest rival, tagging with her biggest rival against her best friend, and she's pissed off because they didn't win. And they throw everything at each other, as you imagine all four of them will do. You know, but it is absolutely supremely a wonderful match. You should have a look at that one as well. But it's one of my favorite Toyota moments because it says an awful lot about her. Alex, what did you think of this final?
Yeah, well, that was something that stood out to me, what you've just said, that, like, it's interesting that she is being presented as, like, this baby face and wearing the pink and stuff, but she has got that edge, and that's, like, classic Manami Toyota. Like, I wrote in my notes, I love that young Manami still gives as few f**ks as later Manami. Because, like, she, you know, she jumps over the referee and drop kicks Hotter, and then she's doing, you know, it's the repeated drop kicks, throws to the outside, jumps from the top rope, which is like, is basically one of her trademarks for how she'd start her matches. And this is like, I mean, what, she must be like 19, 20 here, is that right?
She was 16 when she went to the dojo in 1987, so she'd been 19 years old, the 20 at the oldest.
That is crazy, because I know we're saying she's still a little bit rough around the edges, but she is better here than pretty much any wrestler you will see. Like, it's, and she's 19. And yeah, the stuff where they go through like the big period in the middle where Hotta's putting her in like some horrible looking submissions and Toyota's refusing to give up, and it's like that's classic babyface stuff that, like, you know, people rave about Shawn Michaels and Tanahashi doing that, and she's doing that then, you know what I mean? So and like the closing stretch is incredible with like the slow, you know, the last minute kickouts and stuff like that. And yeah, like you guys have said, it was basically like no one comes out looking bad. You know, Toyota looks amazing for surviving, but Hotta looks incredible for having dished all that out. And she looks like a badass, and Toyota looks like a badass. So yeah, it reminded me a lot, the tournament, of the G1 in 91. Is that the right one off the top of my head? Where they used it and they made stars out of like the younger guys like Muto and Chono and Hashimoto. And it felt a lot like that, like taking younger wrestlers and, like you say, it was setting them up for the next few years of this kind of juggernaut that AJW would become. Yeah, and it's interesting as well because I didn't know that Hokuto was originally booked to win this, and you wouldn't get that from watching this. It feels like Toyota was being set up to win, which is pretty incredible on the fly booking. So yeah, that was interesting. Like, because I don't know what you guys thought. It just felt like the way they booked it from then on.
It was fake.
Would have assumed Toyota. Yeah, exactly. You would have assumed Toyota was booked to win it from the start because the story was so well done, particularly in the final.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Chelsea. Just the way things turned out. That's it. Mm. You know,
imagine having Manami Toyota as your second choice.
That's how good that period was.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, but you're right what you're saying, Alex. Like Norio Tatano, this kind of is one of her last appearances for AJW. She's reached the 26 rules, so she's kind of done. Grizzly Yamamoto is the other girl. She's the one that supports the major star. She isn't the major star. Nishiwaki again fades away, so they are concentrating on the young talents who are going to be the backbones of the company for the next few years. One thing I did want to have a chat with you about just before we finished on this particular one, Manami Toyota's selling is just so good, and a lot of it comes down to her flexibility, like you were saying, like Hotta essentially just trying to break her in half a lot of the time, or it just makes it look like she's breaking it in half. But I've never seen anyone sell as well as Manami Toyota. Her facial expressions are just superb. But I think it comes down to her basic physiology of her being able to bend and move completely differently to any other human being I've ever come across.
It does, but like you say, it's the facial expressions and it's stuff that a lot of young wrestlers can learn from, basically. Because it's, you know, when... I've said this quite a few times, what I see as a babyface is that, like, it's not what people like John Cena and Roman Reigns do, where they, you know, just are strong and beat everyone for...
They're supermen, they're not babyfaces.
Yeah. Yeah, like, that's simplifying it a bit, but, like, it's more like what Manami was doing, what Tanahashi does, what HBK did, what Sami Zayn and Bayley do now, where it's like you're rooting for those people because their selling is so good, and when they're in a submission, you like, you don't want to see them give up, you want to see them fight through it, but they might not be able to. It's that kind of, it's creating drama, basically.
And Toyota does it so well, you know, and then especially the match with Hokuto earlier on the card as well. Just another classic example of her, like, how she toyed with the emotions of wrestling fans, really.
Which is what it should be, in my opinion.
She makes a surfboard stretch. I'm sorry, I'm watching it in the background as we're talking about this. And she makes a surfboard stretch look painful and natural.
Yeah.
And that is a move that now, when you see it, most of the time it's played for ridiculousness, right? Like, it's supposed to be kind of comedic, like... It's not something where you look at it and think, my God, that's grotesque. She should put her opponent down. That's not fair. But that's what I'm feeling watching Yumiko Hoda hoist Manami Toyota over her head. Like, she just does the pain faces so well.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much of that is that she genuinely feels that, like, competitive determination. Like, when she's in a position where she's losing, she's, like, sort of at war with herself.
Yeah.
It's really, really amazing.
Yeah, you're right. That move is something always a bit... Like, because I grew up with British wrestling, and Steve Gray and Johnny Saint could make a surfboard last for 4 minutes, one spot. And it would be a compelling... It would be a pivotal point in the wrestling match, because if they got it on, it would be a submission, almost guaranteed. If they got it on and they managed to survive it, it would be like they'd be selling the back for the rest of the match. You know, and so, like, you're right. It is a bit sad that it's no longer...
Yeah. Well, I mean, things ebb and flow in and out of, you know, use. It may come back as that someday, but how many wrestlers can you think of who can sell all those things at the same time? You know, not many.
No, true. But Toyota was one, and she's one of the best still to this day, 47 odd years old.
Yeah. Well, both you guys have said to me you think she's the greatest wrestler of all time.
Yes.
So, would you stand by that?
Undoubtedly the greatest professional wrestler who ever lived.
I think between the stuff that she innovated and just the skill level, she's certainly like better than most of the dudes that people talk about as being the greatest. And she's probably the greatest. Like I'm trying to think of anybody that can compete with that. There's people that build upon the stuff that she did so frequently. Like she just totally changed the art form and changed what it was capable of and continues to be able to do most of her old repertoire, you know, as well as she did when she was like 25.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. You know, she's no longer the Japanese flying angel in that sense of her aerial work is limited, but she's nearly 50 years old and she's 30 pounds heavier now than she was back then, partly to prolong her career so she can take bumps a lot better than when then. She means she was rail thin in comparison to like even her contemporaries at the time. Hokuto was probably as thin as she was, you know, and taking bumps from the top rope on a nightly basis with that kind of frame is not good
so
for your
dangerous.
Body. You know, yeah, especially when you don't have an awful lot of fat to cushion your fall. And for me, it's like, essentially, she was the best aerial wrestler that ever lived. You know, and people will argue that Liger and Sabu were better, but no one did what she did. They didn't move it along as fast as she did. They didn't do it as well as she did. They didn't do it with believability the way she did. She's the best mat wrestler I've ever seen. And her brawling ability was just phenomenally off the page for someone who was so good at everything else. And you believed what she was doing. You truly believed she was in peril. You truly believed that she thought she was the greatest pro wrestler of all time. Mm. You know, and that's the key thing. You know, there are guys who ooze belief. Ric Flair oozes belief, but I don't think he's the greatest pro wrestler of all time. You know, he's good at being Ric Flair, and he's
the
good.
Skill level isn't quite there, but the charisma is off the charts.
Yeah. So to me, it's like, no, knock on Flair. I mean, he's done amazing, amazing things. Don't get me wrong, but he didn't change the way the business. He was. How can I put it? He was an advancement of a template that was already there, whereas Toyota threw away the template and started again. That's the thing for me. That's the reason why.
Yeah, there you go. No. Doesn't come
James,
much higher than that.
I have to ask, what was it like seeing her? You just saw her live like a month ago, right?
It was absolutely phenomenal. Like, it for those of you who have been to Resistance Gallery in London, where Lucha Underground have their shows, which is where the show is, a large garage with a wrestling ring in it and a sound system and a bar. So it's very tight. It's very packed. There's no seating. It's all standing. And it was an absolute killer card on the way to that match. So everyone's amped and everyone's like really into it, wrestling fans.
Yeah.
And it's really well paced. So everyone's on edge when she comes down, and just like crowd just did not stop singing for the entire match. And she just did everything crisp, perfectly. Nothing was out of place. It's exactly what you would expect Manami Toyota. And it wasn't just reeling off a list of moves either. It was a well-told story within the match. And Blue Nikita was a perfect opponent for her as well. She was incredibly good. Not seen Blue Nikita before in person either. And I wanted to watch her for years too. So seeing them wrestle each other was fantastic. And then Nikita cried at the end of the match.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Because the only reason why she wanted to be as a pro wrestler was because of Manami Toyota, and the fact that she got to wrestle
nice.
Her was just, you know, and Blue Nikita wrestled as a heel through the entire match, and the entire crowd just went with her when she started to cry. And I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it now. It was that cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. And I'm back at the Resistance Gallery in 2 weeks from yesterday to see Meiko Satomura. So,
yay!
Good year for you.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. We're going to see if we can get Dan Reed on here or Emily Reed, either of them. You know, then come and talk on the Drooping Show anytime about that. So, hopefully, I'll get hold of them this week. But yes, so that's pretty much as our coverage of All Japan Grand Prix 1990 written up. Unless you guys have got anything else to say about this particular tournament, Alex, have you got anything you'd like to share?
AJW is great. we should do more podcasts about it.
Okay, we shall do. We've got another 15 years of AJW cards to pick from, I'm sure we can find something you'll like.
Yeah, like I say, this is my era, sort of 92 to 95, when I've watched a lot from that period. So it's interesting to see something slightly before that that led into, you know, Toyota, Hakuta, Asia Kong, like what they would become in the years following.
Mm. So Chelsea, what was your impressions of the overall card? What would you like to say?
This is great, and if you haven't seen it yet, you should watch it. And I would also totally be down for doing more AJW coverage, because it'll give me an excuse to watch it.
So there you go.
This genuinely is like a really good starting point, I think, for anyone who hasn't watched like any Joshi before. Like, I think it's a really good introduction.
Yeah, it kind of like it puts a nice stamp on the end of the Crush Girls era and moves you forward. If you watch from here forward, you won't really have lost anything. I know what was really interesting, the thing we didn't mention actually, was just before the final, there was a promo of Bull Nakano saying, I don't speak Japanese, but I assume she was saying, you can win the All Japan Grand Prix, but I'm still the world champion. And that's the next big story to tell. Bull Nakano's babyface reign as WWA heavyweight champion. WWA heavyweight champion. And yeah, I have to concur. AJW is great, and you'd be a fool and a communist to think otherwise. But there you go. Thank you very much for listening to the Troopany Show today. I would like to thank Mr. Alexander Watt, AlexWatt187 on Twitter. If you would like to talk to him, he will talk to you about wrestling.
I will. I will tell you why AJ Styles versus John Cena was not on the level of Kazuchika Okada versus Kenny Omega, and you are very silly if you think so.
Oh God, people really said that.
Yeah, people really did. I watched it. I basically watched it this morning because I'm like running behind because I've been so busy. I was like, yeah, it's really good, but are people really comparing those two matches? Like,
the WWE fans who must insist on their stuff's better than
everybody else. They want to believe so hard.
Yeah, bless them. You know, I mean, it's their cool thing, but it's that tribal thing. And there's a whole other conversation we're going to have one day about tribalism in pro wrestling
for
fans.
Podcast.
Yes, let's not do that right now. We have other things to talk about. I'd also like to thank Chelsea Spollen of shouldersup.net. You can find her at Chelsea Comics and shoulders_up on Twitter, where she tweets for the Shoulders Up account. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
And you can listen to other things on the Wrestle Talk Podcast Network. There is the Squash, which comes up on fortnightly these days. And also there is the Finn Martin Report, which comes out on the alternate weeks. Thank you very much for listening today. You can find other things on the Wrestle Talk Podcast Network, like the Squash and the Finn Martin Report. And if you listen to us on Wrestle Plus, you can vote over to the video sections where you can find Wrestling Histories, which from now on will be hosted by myself and Finn Martin. And we're looking at 1994 in episode 22, which should be up there by the time you're listening to this. And you can go back and listen to all the other things as well. $4.99 a month for lots of cool wrestling content. Thank you very much for your time. Take care, and we will see you soon. Bye.